Good evening, and you are very welcome to this week's episode of Let's Go Green here on Midlands 103. I'm your host, Aisling O'Rourke, and I hope you are safe and well as you tune in this week. First things first, thank you so much to all of you who entered our competition last week. So I hope our prize winners are impressed with all of the fabulous, sustainable, locally made gifts that will be going under your tree this Christmas season. Now, we have been talking on and off about the deposit return scheme and the coffee cup levy over the course of this year. And we are joined now by Minister Ossian Smith to discuss what the government plans to do about all of this. Minister, you're most welcome to the programme.
Hi, Aisling. Thanks very much for having me on your show.
Now, it's been a year of announcements in terms of the circular economy. And this is a new phrase that we're all getting used to again. But from your own perspective, Minister, what exactly does it mean?
Well, the idea is to avoid waste. The idea is that we treat waste as a resource. And a lot of it is about going back to practices that we used to have in the past that would be familiar to our parents or our grandparents' generation. So that when nothing really went to waste. So the idea is that instead of always buying new and then using it up and then throwing it away and having it going into landfill, that we would try to make sure that either we avoid the waste in the first place or that we reuse the products more than once. So that's really the basic idea. And just to give you a concrete idea, example. If your shoes wear out, instead of buying brand new shoes, that you would go bring them down to the shoemaker and have them fixed. Or if you have a zip has gone on your clothes, that you go around and instead of going around to your fast fashion outlet and buying a new one that's more in fashion, that you'd actually go around to the alterations and have it repaired. So you can see that in that kind of economy, there's a lot more work in the areas of renovation and fixing and less work in the area of manufacturing.
On that point about bringing your items of clothing for repair, do we face a challenge in that, like for instance, a cobbler? It's quite hard to find a good cobbler in Ireland at the moment. And I know in Dublin there are one or two well-known outlets, but in the Midlands, like, I have to admit, hands up, I have an extensive shoe collection. I will. It's a guilty pleasure. But I do, like, you know, I used to go, there was a person that I used to go to regularly. COVID hit, they're gone. Though there are skills that maybe we let die out. Are we now struggling to bring them? Do we have people who are interested in bringing them back?
Yeah, I want to encourage more of that. So I want to make sure that that those choices exist. We have a website called repairmystuff.ie, and the idea is that it shows you the nearest person in your area who can fix whatever you have that's broken. And part of this is I'm talking to Minister Simon Harris about how we can have apprenticeship courses to train people for those skills so that there is somebody available. So really, I suppose the direction of the government is trying to make it easy for you, that this is the obvious choice, or this is the simplest or the cheapest option for you, the sensible thing to do. Not that people would do it to be good to the environment or something like that, but that it would be the reasonable, best thing to do. And we think if we give people the information, show them how to do it, provide them with everything they need, that will be the choice that they make. I wasn't aware that there's a shortage of shoemakers in the Midlands. There are plenty around where I live in Dublin, but I didn't realise that it's beginning to disappear. Would you find that if you were in Tullamore or in Mullingar or somewhere, would you find that it was difficult to get somebody to repair clothes or shoes?
Okay, well, as a Tullamore woman, I call myself an awfully, awfully proud Dublin resident. As a Tullamore woman, I know Tullamore, for example, doesn't have a population of, 15,000? We don't have a cobbler.
Well, I went around Tullamore one day with Pippa Hackett, who is an awfully beef farmer, but also a minister in the government. And she took me around the charity shops, which is her favourite thing, charity shopping. And there were loads. Like, I mean, there were probably eight of them in the town.
Yeah, there's something about it. Tullamore is a bit of a mecca for charity shopping, all right. And like, look, we've loads of alterations people and all of that. But just on the cobbler, I'm only raising it with you because you mentioned it yourself. It is something that you see get mentioned on social media an awful lot, people talking about it. But where do we find one in the Midlands? It seems to be And for people listening, if you wanted a new career, there's certainly a vacancy in the market there. And I suppose my broader point is, you know, that these skills, and like you mentioned at the very beginning, these skills that perhaps our grandparents had are skills that have, for whatever reason, not been valued. And, you know, and I suppose we can't really be as environmentally friendly as we would like to be without these services.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think it is important that we are providing the training so that people can learn those skills, but also that we're encouraging people and giving them the information. And the reason I mentioned charity shops is that they're a circular economy. It's a pure circular economy. You know, you bring back clothes that don't fit you anymore. You get clothes from somebody else. It saves you money. It's just it's a practical, realistic thing to do. And the whole shopping experience is so different because you're not buying something that everybody else has. You get something kind of, and you might have to bring it along to an alterations place afterwards to have it customized just to fit you, or to have it mended before you can wear it. So, you know, I think that all that kind of, you know, a library is part of circular economy. All those things are all around us. And I think that, you know, particularly if you go back to the previous generation, they didn't waste things. Nothing went to waste in the kitchen. Things were always reused. And that industries a lot of the time made sure that whatever their byproducts were, that they circulated around to be the inputs for another business. So, for example, there was a vegetable shop down the road from me in Dublin, and they had pigs out the back, and that was very common. And any vegetables that were unsold were fed to the pigs, and then the slurry from the pigs was sent back to the farmer who sold the vegetables. So when the vegetables were delivered, the slurry went back the other direction, and the slurry was used to fertilize the vegetables. So you have an absolute, even a circle there, and all those type of cycles existed much more than they do now, because now we kind of replaced all that with, well, you get something from the other side of the world, you put it in a shipping container, send it over to Ireland, use it up, burn it, throw it in a field. So that, I suppose that's the linear economy, which is the opposite of the circular economy. So some of the things we're trying to do, we're bringing in a deposit return scheme. So the idea of this is that you get money back on your cans and bottles. So if you go shopping, you bring back any empty cans or bottles you have, and you get the deposit back on them. And that's just to make sure that we're not they're not being left as litter in the fields, or that they're not being thrown into the general disposal or being burnt. So that, I think that's going to lead to, it's something that's been going on for 20 years in Germany. Mm-hmm. And I think it's going to have a dramatic effect on the landscape. It's going to greatly reduce litter, but it's also going to provide much more plastic and aluminium to be recycled rather than disposed of at the end of its life. So that's a deposit return scheme. And
I'm not asking you to defend other governments in the past, but like Germany, I remember as a teenager spending a summer going to school in Germany and discovering this deposit return scheme, or their version of it there, and kind of being blown away by the logic and how simple and easy it was. Why has it taken us so long in Ireland to bring in things like this? And I even like, well, I was delighted to hear your announcement the other week, and then there was that, well, it won't come into place until 2024. And you and I both know a week is a long time in politics, never mind a year. So, you know, what is it that's holding us back in bringing the deposit return scheme into place? We've been talking about it for a long time. What is it that's delaying getting it up and running?
Well, we're certainly not the last country. So if you're in the Scandinavian countries, it's completely normal and it's been there for decades. But if you were in Italy or Spain or France, they don't have that either. So we're certainly not the last person in Europe to be doing it. And the fact that there are other countries that have done it already means that we can copy their systems. And I was able to get the supermarket owners in Ireland to go and visit the supermarket owners in Germany and see how it works there, so that they could compare notes. But for them, for the shops, they tell me that a year is a really, really short time frame to change over. Whereas everybody else, the population, wants it to happen tomorrow. There are a lot of pilot schemes have already happened. So okay, if you're in the Dunns in Nace, you'll see that there's a machine outside. And in fact, if you're in the Aldi in Nace, the same thing. And I know that Lidl has done it in Dublin in some shops. So the shops are getting ready, and they're getting used to it, and they're putting out the machines and trying them out. And over the course of the next year, every shop in Ireland will be equipped to take back these bottles and cans. So it does take a while to get all the machines rolled out, and the smaller shops won't have machines at all. So if you're a news agent, you know, you're just going to have a bag, and you know, you take back the bags and hand back the money out of the till. So that's how that's going to work for smaller retailers. And again, that's how it works in other countries. So it's something that you're going to see over the course of a year. And I know I'd love if it could happen overnight, but this is the fastest that it can reasonably be done.
I suppose the reason, 2024, like at this point now, we're obviously none of us can tell the future, but we're halfway through the term of this current government. By 2024, we're going to be like well into election territory and election campaigning. And well, it could be easy for a project like this to fall down the priority list.
You know, several environment ministers before me announced schemes like this and never managed to get them off the ground.
Yeah,
I passed the law to do it. I've got the budget to do it. The machines have started to appear. I've appointed the company that's going to do the work. So, you know, it's all underway. And I think that that's been the pattern for a lot of things. Like we've now passed our 100,000th rural fiber broadband home so far. And again, that's a project that was talked about for 10 years. And eventually the last 2 years I've been working on that, and it's really beginning to fly. So, you know, I wouldn't, I know there's sometimes a sense of, oh, these things are never going to happen, or an election will come around. But I'm certain that this is happening.
So this is something you're going to ensure happens. You're taking it in charge. Is that
I'll tell
is that
you
what
one
you're
reason it's going to happen? It's because my heart is really in it. Like, okay, I was really into this before I ran for election as a TD. I remember doing up the policy and going out to the newspapers and saying we should have a deposit return scheme. I even stood outside my local supermarket with a sign saying too much plastic. And I asked the supermarket if they'd take back the plastic from behind the till. So, you know, because my heart is really in it, because I'm putting a whole lot of energy into it, because I've got the budget, because I've passed the law, because I've appointed the people to do it, it's happening, I can tell you. And I'll tell you what, you come back to me, Aisling, in a year, and if it's not done, I'll buy you dinner.
Well, thank you very much. I will hold you to that, Minister. Now, the coffee cup levy. Now, I know it'll be on tea takeaway cups of tea as well, but what's the status of that at the moment?
Yeah, it's a levy on disposable cups. And we are the first country in the world to bring this in. So you were saying with the deposit return scheme, we're the last country. But in fact, no other country has done this. We are using 200 million coffee cups, disposable cups a year. And I think it's something relatively new, because you go back 20 years ago, we were using none, you know. So it's something that became a trend and became very popular, that you get a takeaway coffee. And it became a victim of its own success. 200 million cups is a bit much, and it's a significant part of litter at this stage. But also it's a dreadful waste. It's a waste of money, and it's a waste of resources to have, you know, the product that's manufactured of paper and plastic and then used for a few seconds and then thrown away. So what we're going to do is we're putting a small levy on the cups, and you don't have to pay the levy if you bring your own cup, or if you borrow a cup from the cafe, or if you use a crockery mug or whatever. So we've done the law for it. We've had a public consultation, which has just finished, where we talked to the cafes. And that public consultation is to figure out exactly how is this going to be implemented. You know, is there anyone who gets an exemption? Is there any case where you wouldn't charge it? So, for example, we're not going to charge 20 cents on a cup for a children's birthday party, for example. You know, you get a box of cups, so we're not going to charge it on that. But there are maybe other circumstances where it shouldn't be charged, and we want to make sure that it works in practice. But at the end of the day, this is very similar to the plastic bag levy. Okay. So the plastic bag levy works by putting a small fee on a plastic bag. It appears separately on your till receipt. You don't have to pay it if you bring your own bags, if you remember to. So it's a very similar idea. And so instead of bags, it's cups. And what we found in no country has done this before, but some cities have. Vancouver has done it. And what they found is that cafes bring in schemes to share cups. So in other words, they'll, if you don't remember to bring a plastic cup, which obviously you're not going to half the time, they will lend you a cup, or they'll charge a deposit and you get it back when you hand the cup back. And you can hand the cup back to another cafe if you want. You can keep it for a week or whatever. So nobody is going to be caught short, but we want a system that works for everybody. And I suppose some of the concerns are coming back from the cafes about how it's implemented. You know, there were people saying they were worried that the people would come in with really filthy cups, for example. So, you know, you're not forced to serve coffee to somebody who gives you a filthy cup. And we want to make sure that there are, that we get over that problem. There was fears during the pandemic that you might catch COVID from a cup or something, and that if somebody gave a cup to the person in the cafe, that they might catch COVID from it, and so on and so on. So all of those things have been looked at. We're working through the concerns from the cafes, and it'll be 3 months into next year before we're ready to start charging for the cups.
I know that some cafes are already, they're out of the gates with it as well. I know where I live, like my local coffee shop does, you know, they'll give you 20 cent off or whatever it is if you bring in your own cup. And I said this before and people will argue the toss with me on it, but a paper cup of coffee does not taste as good as one, a regular cup, either a hard plastic or a ceramic one. And I don't care who argues with me on that one. But there will be people who claim that maybe there are so many coffee cups and these waste from teas and coffees and takeaway drinks, because in an awful lot of towns, it became fashionable over the years to get rid of bins. And we have a lack of places to dispose of these things and even dispose of them correctly. Like, are there any efforts in that regard?
You know, if you are not taking a paper cup, then you don't have the waste problem. Mm-hmm. So you're not throwing your cup on the ground. And, you know, that's certainly a part of the problem. One of the problems that you have in not just in rural Ireland, but in urban Ireland, is people dumping, people going around to people's houses and saying, I'll remove your rubbish for a cut price. And they put it in a trailer and you don't know where it goes. And where it really goes is they just go off to a field and in the middle of the night, throw it away. So when the county councils tried to prosecute people for that, they were able to defend themselves by saying that it was a breach of their privacy to be filmed without their permission. Mm-hmm. And this worked. So earlier this year, I changed the law to allow county councils to use CCTV to catch people who were dumping. And this isn't about littering. This is commercial dumping, where you've got a lorry load of waste and you're throwing it in a field or in a beauty spot. And so for the first time, county councils are going to be able to use CCTV to catch people. And I also put in to allow them to use drones and body cams if they need to, because sometimes people are carrying out illegal dumps behind a high wall and you need some way to get over and collect the evidence. So I think that is going to have a dramatic effect on the level of kind of heavy dumping that happens in rural areas and in remote areas. And it's shocking if you get to a remote valley somewhere and you are going along and you see sofas or washing machines thrown in the field and
or mattresses.
Yeah. I mean, there's a brilliant project in Galway called Bounce Back Mattresses. And they're collecting mattresses and recycling them. It's a project that's run by travelers and it's been really successful. And that's a pure circular economy type of business. So one of the things you find in circular economy is just all these new types of businesses start emerging that are based on taking away things that are waste to other people and which they're paid to take away. Then they do something to it and they have a product that they can sell on to someone else. So mattresses are a real problem. I want to see those piles of mattresses you see out in remote fields. I want to see the end of that.
Yes, there's a blue van who comes almost monthly to dump a mattress on the side of the road where I live. So it's a bit of a bugbear of mine. I'll be with you on that one, Minister. So look, we're at the point, as I said, halfway through the government, we're going to have Leo Varadkar reinstalled as Taoiseach in the coming weeks. And obviously that will lead to some form of cabinet reshuffle. You've promised that we're going to get the coffee cup levy, we're going to get the deposit return scheme. But in order for all that to happen, you have to stay in office. Have you been given any guidance on that as of yet?
Thanks, Ashling, for saying I have to stay in office. Yeah, I don't know what's going to happen. In a few days' time, a new government is going to be announced, and I might be in it and I might not. So I there's not much I can do to affect that. I feel that that I've been in for 2 years. It's not a very long time in any job.
No.
And I think that the first few months in any position, you're getting up to speed, and there's a huge amount to take in. And my preference would be to stay in my current job and keep going, because I want to get these things over the line. I want people to be able to walk up to their shop and with bottles and cans and get money back on them. And I want to think, yeah, I did that. I don't want the next guy getting in doing it for me.
Well,
so,
I,
so I've no, there's no way I can know whether I'm going to get reappointed.
Well, if not, Minister, I shall look forward to that dinner in early 2024. Minister Ossian Smith, thank you very much for joining us on this week's episode of Let's Go Green here on Midlands 103. You're listening to Let's Go Green here on Midlands 103, and I hope you enjoyed our interview with Minister Ossian Smith there. Let me know what you think about it. And are you maybe perhaps as cynical as I am in relation to the deposit return scheme coming in force in 2024? I genuinely hope I'm wrong. I just, you know, it does feel a little bit far off now, a bit further off than we were hoping, at least put it that way. But we're joined now by our old friend Niall Hatch of Birdwatch Ireland. Niall, welcome to the programme. What's the story with the poor robins? What's all this issue with traffic? Are they not used to it at this stage?
Well, it seems that many of them are, or many robins probably have known nothing but traffic throughout their lives. But there has been some interesting research reported recently from the UK, and I think some other studies elsewhere in the world too, showing that robins that live in areas with high levels of traffic noise tend to be more aggressive than robins that live in quieter locations. Robins are actually very aggressive birds to begin with. We humans like to think of them as being cute and cuddly and very friendly. But in fact, while they might be friendly towards humans, they tend not to be so friendly towards others of their own kind. You don't tend to see flocks of robins in your garden during the winter, for example. During the summer, you'll see the male and female together when they're nesting, because it takes two to tango after all. But they go their separate ways in the winter, and they keep separate territories indeed during the winter months. That's actually one of the reasons why robins are one of the only birds we have that sings throughout all 12 months of the year, because singing is a very aggressive thing. And this study has actually focused on that, on the volume and intensity of the singing of robins in different locations, and have found that the robins in urban areas, at least in the UK, tend to sing louder and longer and more aggressively than those in other areas. So they're getting more worked up for sure.
Okay, hold on a second now. You kind of blew my mind here now, because I like to think it's the same robin each year, and I know it's not, okay? But the logical part of my brain knows it's not. But we do have a robin that comes to the garden each and every year. And, you know, it seems actually each year it's getting a bit closer to the house. It's getting a bit more friendly. But anyway, and I know it's the same one, but let me be sentimental about it.
Absolutely.
But singing, aggressive. Since when has singing been aggressive?
Well, for us humans, it generally isn't. But for birds, that's one of the main points of singing. That's why they do it. They don't sing because they're full of the joys of spring or because they want to make us humans feel happy. In fact, they couldn't care less what we humans think of them. It's just a happy coincidence that we enjoy their songs. For most birds, singing is actually, it's a form of defending a territory and also trying to impress and attract a mate. So usually for most birds, singing is really just the preserve of the spring and summer time of year. So most birds don't sing in the autumn and the winter. Mm-hmm. And the robin being one of the notable exceptions, because that's obviously when the breeding season is underway. And birds, I suppose, that for want of a better expression can waste the better part of their day singing, are sending a very clear message to all the rivals in the neighbourhood that they're very fit and strong and healthy, and they would make a formidable adversary. So they deserve that really prime territory.
Okay.
And also, the birds can also tell if their singing isn't quite up to scratch, or if they're not, you know, singing first thing in the morning, or if they're quite weak, or they're taking long gaps, they will think, there's something wrong with him. He's weak. I could take over part of his territory. I could easily steal his mate, and they move in. I'm not being sexist, by the way, in saying he in this case, because for almost all Irish birds, it's just the male that sings. Again, the robin being an exception, but the robin, both the male and the female sing. So birdsong to human ears, it's a very pretty thing, and long may that continue. I love the dawn chorus myself, but to the birds, it's actually a very serious business, very aggressive.
So a little bit like why my rather small 7 kg Jack Russell loves to bark when she's out and about at absolutely everything, like, and basically nothing as well, just to show whoever may be listening that she's not to be messed with. Or at least that's how I like to think about it. This is because I knew that birds sang to attract a mate, but I never knew it was about defending their territory. And but the more you explain it, it seems very logical. Okay, right. So we have an island where we are not quite divided between urban and rural areas, but it's kind. It seems we do have clusters of urban areas, maybe not as large as elsewhere in the world, let's be honest about it. But and we do have a particular issue here in Ireland with traffic and traffic noise. So how were they how did the researchers know this singing and the aggression in the singing and that it's to do with traffic and not just, well, anything else?
The way they would do that is by looking at the other factors and trying to rule them out. So they say, like, all of things being equal, what are the variables that we see here? The robin is a very good species to study for these kind of things, because our studies here in Ireland and elsewhere in Europe show that they are equally as common in urban as in rural areas. So within Ireland, we know from our Irish Garden Bird Survey, which is underway at the moment, it'll run up until the end of February. We're asking people over the country to take part in that. We know from that that the robin is the bird reported in the most gardens in Ireland. Over 99% of gardens in the survey, I think it's 99.6% actually, have robins in them each year. And that's regardless of whether they're in urban, suburban, or rural areas. So the robin makes a very good test subject for this, because it's absolutely everywhere. And what they were able to assess by this, you can tell how agile is how frequently it sings and how it responds to other robins singing nearby, coming near its territory. And one of the theories here is, with the prevalence of traffic noise, which these robins in these areas probably haven't known anything else, they've lived there all their lives, as you said, unfortunately they do have a very short lifespan. So if a robin makes it to the age of 3, that's old age for a robin. Most don't make it that far, so they've known nothing different all their lives. But the volume of traffic noise that they become accustomed to means that they would have to sing a bit louder to be able to get over that sound, so that they could still be heard, which causes them stress in that case as well. But also it may mean that their neighbours are less likely to hear them at low volume, which means there's more territorial incursions because they're not heard, and that then leads sometimes to physical confrontation. So that tends to be what's happening with the robins. And as I said, it's a very good subject species to test this on, because they're absolutely everywhere. I'm sure it holds true for other bird species as well. They're less easy to track between urban and rural areas.
Might this explain why, and I hate bringing the thing back into it, but you might remember you and I spoke, Niall, during the pandemic, and when people were talking, something's falling down around me here in the home studio. Apologies for that. But there was conversations, and people were saying we were getting out and about. There was no traffic because nobody could go anywhere. Well, there was some traffic, but basically none. And there was this constant conversation around the birds seem an awful lot louder than they did before. And we were kind of saying, oh, don't be ridiculous, it's just because there's no traffic on the roads. But actually, might they have been louder because they've had to become louder over the years than maybe they would have been when we last had periods of quiet roads?
Possibly so. We do know from other studies that certain species like blue tits and great tits, two other very common birds in both urban and rural areas, we do know that from studies in Germany particularly, that they have changed their song slightly in built-up areas. In urban areas, but also along motorways, they tend to have a song that's a bit louder, but also crucially a bit higher in pitch, because the higher a sound is, the more it'll cut through low rumbling background noise. So a lot of traffic noise tends to be down towards the lower end of the sound spectrum. And so from that point of view, we do know that has change their song. And then, of course, that's the way that those birds have learned to sing, because with our songbirds, they don't have their song genetically encoded in them like some other birds do, like pigeons, for example, or cuckoos. The songbirds we have, like the robins, they have to learn that song from their own parents. And so if they learn the loud version, realize that's how they're supposed to sing, it stands to reason that if all of a sudden that background noise of the traffic and other sounds disappears, well, they're still singing at the same volume. So it's not that those birds themselves became louder because of the absence of traffic, it's that they became more audible because there was no background noise for them to compete with. And also that would then therefore lead to that song carrying a bit further. So people became more aware of the birds and their surroundings. Some of the more distant ones would normally have been drowned out. And people tuned into that particularly. And I think people seized on that at the start of the lockdown period as well, because that coincided with the peak of the Dáil chorus in Ireland. Yeah, and actually people were stuck at home, were stuck within their 2K as it was at the start, and got more familiar with these sounds of nature around them. I think for a lot of people, it became a real source of comfort and solace, and indeed entertainment, to try and what, see these birds and listen to them singing, and became more aware of that. And we're hoping in Birdwatch Ireland now, as life is returning to normal, we're hoping that people won't forget that connection with nature, that people will realize that nature is still all around them, but that it needs help. And, you know, it helped us out during the dark days. It's time to return the favor, I would say.
Question for you, and this is more a trivia question, but I'm hoping you will know the answer. That quote, that little, and it's cheesy and sentimental and all of that, but when robins appear, loved ones are near, where did that come from back in the day?
It's difficult to know, because this is something you see across many different cultures. It's not just here in Ireland, all across Europe where robins occur. Robins are essentially a European bird. You find them a little bit parts of North Africa and into slight bits of Asia, but mostly just within Europe. And we know throughout many cultures that the robin is associated with feelings of affection and friendship. There's many associations with Christmas as well for various reasons. Mm-hmm. But also it's the bird that tends to be the tamest around humans, particularly around our homes. So they come close to us. We observe them up close. We humans like to think of that as behavior as being friendly. In fact, the robins, as far as we can tell, they don't have any affection for us particularly. They just realize that we're not so bad and that other birds aren't brave enough to come and take food that's near us. So if the robin can exploit us a bit by taking care of or taking advantage of the protection that we have around us, it's almost like we have this invisible force field around us that things like foxes and hawks won't breach. That other birds are scared of, like say blackbirds, for example, but that the robin has learned it can go through and get the protection from. I think that's why we like to think of them as being friendly, because they seem to follow us around. They seem to lavish attention upon us. But the reasons for doing that are quite selfish. And, you know, sometimes people are upset to find that out, to learn about it. But I would say we humans are the most selfish species of all. So, you know, we're judging them by a different standard if we feel sorry about that.
Well, I'm going to stick with my love of robins and remember as a kid being very impressed by how clever my father was, that he could convince the robins to come so close to him. But Niall, remind us of this garden survey you want us to take part in.
Yes, it would be great if as many listeners as possible would take part in this. It's the Irish Garden Bird Survey. This is the 34th winter in a row that we've done it. So we've got a long established history of that, of data being gathered by people all over Ireland. Thousands of people take part each winter. We ask people over the course of a 13-week period that runs up until the end of February, we ask them to keep note of the different species of birds that come into their garden each week, but not just that, the highest number of each species they see at any one time. So it's not cumulatively counting the birds. You look out your window 1 minute, see one robin, look 2 minutes later, see a robin, could be the same one, count it again. No, it's the amount that you see at any one time. And then at the end of that period, you send the data back to us in Birdwatch Ireland. There's two ways you can do that. You can enter the data directly as you go throughout the winter on the form you can get on our website. It's birdwatchireland.ie. Or you can also download a PDF form, print it out, have it on your kitchen table or your windowsill, tick off the birds as you go throughout the week. And then at the end of that, we ask people at the end of February, you know, into March, April, to send that back to us. We then spend a few months entering and compiling all that data, crunching all the numbers, and it gives us a really good indication of what's happening to our common bird populations all across Ireland. Sometimes people think that Birdwatch Ireland would only be interested in assessing rare bird populations, and although that's very important, we can actually tell a lot more from assessing the common birds, because although they may remain common, we do see fluctuations for good or for bad in their numbers, and that tells us a lot about what's going on.
Well, Niall Hatch from Birdwatch Ireland, thank you once again for joining us on Let's Go Green here on Midlands 103. You're listening to Let's Go Green here on Midlands 103. Well, last week we did an entire segment, with thanks to our local enterprise offices in Laois, Offaly, Westmeath, of gifts that we could be giving this Christmas that are fully sustainable in that they are made right here in the Midlands, no air miles involved. And we're staying with that theme in that we're speaking to local author now, Rachel McKenna. Rachel, you've just published your new book, Traditional Architecture in Offaly. Congratulations.
Thank you very much. Delighted. And yes, it was full. It's all about the county, and also it was designed by myself, so all within the county again. And then it was printed through Dear McGuinan and Brosna Press. So it was wonderful to have it fully complete in the county. Fantastic.
That is fantastic, because oftentimes when you have to print, and like a lot of authors are forced to go outside of the country because of the costs involved and all of that. So so that is indeed a fantastic to hear. Now, traditional architecture in Offaly, when I hear that phrase, I'm thinking thatched houses, cottages, farm buildings, perhaps. But what have you discovered in your work in putting this book together?
Well, initially it came about with the call from Anne-Maria Egan about their family home in Carrageen, and it had been thatched, but it had a corrugated roof. So these are all often called thatched, tin and corrugated metal, or thatch under tin. So a lot of the time they wouldn't be as noticeable, and in some cases there could be many hidden treasures within those. So yes, it would be thatched properties, and we had a survey carried out in 2004 that showed there were 74 in the county, and that was updated again then in 2018, and those numbers had dropped to 43. So that showed just, you know, how fragile these properties can be, and the importance of, you know, recording them and trying to encourage owners who live in them as well.
And what is it about the subject that interests you?
Well, I suppose one of the main aims was to create an awareness of the craftsmanship involved, and also to highlight the fragile nature, both of the architecture itself and of the fittings within it. And a lot of these fittings, you know, dressers, cup racks, things like that, they might have been made by family members, or they could have been made by friends and neighbours. And it's just there's incredible stories within each of these houses. And that was the real joy of the project, meeting the families and the individuals who care for these homes, because they're really the custodians of our past and a direct link to former generations.
And I'm sure there is a significant level of pride in being able to mind those cottages, those little pieces of history over the generations.
Absolutely. And I mean, that's what's so wonderful, and it really is such a privilege to hear all of those stories that are involved. You know, like the dressers used to be wedding presents often. Mm-hmm. There's settle beds that fold out to become a bed at night. They're a chair during the day. They were often kept as like playpens to keep the kids in them during the day and keep them away from the fire. And then kids sleeping up in the loft overhead, listening to the stories at nighttime down by the hearth. So there's so many of those different stories within each of these, right down to small items and elements, you know, like cracked cups that were mended, lots of fabulous stories.
And like, I think it's something that we are all a little bit sentimental about. And I seem to be talking an awful lot about sentimentality tonight, but maybe it's just the mood of the year. But like, I know myself, when I'm heading to visit my grandparents' house, where my father grew up in Offaly, and I know myself, I'm getting near home when I hit the thatched cottage at the corner, you know, or like, that picture, I have it in my head, you know. It's something that I think as a kid fascinated all of us, but I imagine they're very difficult to maintain.
Well, I suppose, you know, that was the other reason for this, is to highlight the different craftspeople that we have within the county. I mean, one of the first things with thatch is repairing the thatch, and that needs to be repaired every 7 to 10 years. So there's a whole section on thatching and highlighting the different thatchers within the county. And we're very fortunate in Offaly that we do have a good number of thatchers who work within Offaly. But there's other skills as well that was really interesting to learn about. These will be early crafts that are still continued today. You know, there's basket making, furniture repair, and then there's the exceptional craft of God in the Bottle, that only through reading Claudia Kinmont's book on Irish furnishings, we then discovered that there were actual makers of these incredible crafts, where they're like a ship in a bottle, but they're upright. Mm-hmm. And they were made for Easter, so they have a cross and different elements and symbols related to the Passion of Christ. And we have two fantastic craftspeople in the county who still make these today as gifts for people.
This is a new one for me, and I'm guessing many of our listeners. So God in a bottle, right? Okay, so it's like a ship in a bottle. You've got me there. And then what? Yeah.
And well, except it's upright, and okay, there's no glue or anything used. They're tiny little intricate pieces, and nobody knows how they do it except the craftspeople involved. It's a wonderful mystery. So you have a full height cross in the bottle, and then around the cross on the base, there's usually a cruciform base as well. set into that are the different elements, you know, like a spear, a lance, there's sometimes a ladder, a saw, so different elements to do with the Passion of Christ. And these were often put on top of the dresser, and they became a real symbol of home for the family. In some cases, people, if they were emigrating abroad, they would bring the God in a bottle or a cross in a bottle with them, and then as a reminder of home, and bring it back home. So we were really, really fortunate. We, as I say, I saw the lecture with Claudia, and she mentions it in her book, Claudia Kinmoth. And the 2 days later, I was visiting a house out near Belmont, and on top of the dresser, he had one of these God in a bottle. So we went back then and checked with all the other owners' houses we'd been to, and we managed to find 10 in total, and even more unusually, found two craftspeople who still make them today within the county.
Fascinating altogether. And you seem to have developed a fondness for the dresser in these houses. How important was the dresser?
Well, I suppose the dresser was a real area of pride within the household. As Claudia would say, there was no point having a huge dresser if you didn't have the wear or the delf to put on it. I think somebody described it as being like a mouth without teeth if you didn't have it full of fabulous wear. And each piece would be hugely significant. And there's some wonderful quotes, you know, where somebody came back from America and found a new cup on the dresser that his sister hadn't told him about that had been purchased. But each element, you know, if they couldn't afford a dresser initially, they might get a smaller hanging dresser, which was hung up on the wall, or a cup rack was often made by a family member. Like, all of the elements are just, you know, and everything to do with sitting around the hearth and all the accessories and fittings that come with that. So it's just to highlight the importance of these things, where they might have been made by somebody down the road or by a relation, but they're an integral part to the house and the home, and they're extremely easily restored and conserved today as well.
And nowadays, highly fashionable.
Absolutely. Yeah. And what's even more important is to try to retain the sort of patina of age, where you might have different layers of paint built up, because obviously there's all the different phases where they would have been made with different cuts of material, different types of timber. And they were often very richly painted as well, and sometimes with creamy colours or white at the back to highlight the wear on in the front of it, and the wear then often reflected the flames from the fire and again emphasised the importance of what was on display.
I remember when I saw my grandparents' first house many years ago, I went back to do a photography project, and they still had the dresser. The blue and white dresser was still sitting there in the decay of the now abandoned house. And very recently, I have a thing for mid-century modern furniture, and there's an Instagram account that I follow, and up popped my granny's dresser for 500 or 600 euro, and I'm going, God, that's a, you know, these things nowadays, you know, we might have them because they belonged to granny or mammy or dad or whatever it might have been, but you know, they're becoming so popular, we're kind of going back to it. So it seems like your book is coming out at a timely moment. So tell us about it. What will we find out in it, or what will we find in the book?
Well, as I say, it was about creating an awareness of craftsmanship, and it was also about fostering pride in the many of these structures around the county. So it kind of starts by looking at the house in Carrageen that's owned by the Egan family, and they've done so much to retain all of the elements within there, right down to you know, one of the sisters bakes bread in the bastable in front of the fire, the open hearth. They've opened it for Heritage Week. So fantastic amount involved in that. And working with Amanda Pedlow, the heritage officer, we've been really able to promote a lot of those different elements. It also then looks at the setting, how these houses are placed within the countryside and the different buildings around them, whether they had, as you said, farm buildings, because most of the time these were farmhouses, and the types of courtyard that they might have had, whether they were built directly onto the road. And then it looks at the type of plan within them, and then about the construction and the materials. So about the roof, the walls, were they made of mud, were they made of stone? It looks at the windows. We've an interesting mix of some steel windows, some, you know, timber sash windows, right down to doors, some very unusual doors, even in Offaly, where, you know, a lot of people would know the half door, where you can open the full one out and there's a half one then inside, which was used to keep animals out and children in. And you could also hang over it and chat to the friends and neighbours passing by. But in some cases, there wasn't enough room for a door to open fully inwards. So they had these incredible doors that folded in half. You know, okay. So the whole door folded in half and then mm-hmm. folded in within the depth of the wall. So some incredibly intuitive, you know, fabulously inventive items that were made. And then it goes through the interior on a room by room basis. So it looks at the kitchen and all the different elements within that, from the hearth, the dresser, the cup rack, the settle bed, stools, chairs, meal chest, all those kind of elements. And then it goes into the loft, the parlor and the bedroom. And then it kind of finishes up with a social history, looking at quotes from travel writers from the 18th to the 20th century. So a good mix of topics covered.
And Rachel, if perhaps somebody listening is thinking, do you know what, I know someone in my life who would absolutely love this. How do we get our hands on a copy of it?
Well, they can check with our own heritage section within Offaly County Council. Offaly Heritage in Bury Quay, we'll send them anywhere within the country or worldwide. And then there's a lot of different outlets. Again, if they check on the Heritage Office page, there's they've been distributed to a lot of local shops around the county, both within in Birr, Tullamore, Dangan, lots of different local stores, Birr Castle, Midland Books. We'll send them to anywhere within the country or abroad either. So lots of different options.
Well, that book, once again, for everybody listening, is Traditional Architecture in Offaly, and author Rachel McKenna, thank you very much for joining us on this week's episode of Let's Go Green. You're listening to Let's Go Green here on Midlands 103, and I'm afraid that's all we have for this week's episode of the show. My thanks indeed to my contributors each and every week. I hope you enjoyed listening this week, and please do remember that we are available on Spotify, Google and Apple Podcasts, and of course, get in contact with me if you'd like to participate in the show. Drop me a line at letsgogreen@midlands103.com or indeed get in contact with me through the on-air team on midlands103.com. Have a great week, stay safe, and I'll be back same time next week.